everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two sponsors for you, two of the best. Environments for Humans, promoting their CSS Dev Conf. We're going to tell you all about it. It's about on a big, giant boat in California. It's an in-person conference coming up in October, and it's going to be awesome. I'm going to be there. We'll tell you, the URL for it is csdevconf.com. We'll tell you all about what's going to happen there later in the show. And lynda.com. That's lynda.com/shop talk, which give, you know, if you're already a member of them, awesome. If you're not already a member, go to /shop talk at that URL and sign up for your 10-day free trial. It is a learning resource, the largest of its kind on the web. You can learn just about anything through their high-quality video tutorials on lynda.com. We'll tell you about some of our favorites later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
That's right. I am here. I am with you. I am present. And it's just us two today. It is a rapid fire episode. That's right. We've had a long string of guests here.
Which is wrapping pretty nice. Up kind of a good first half of the season, huh?
Yeah. I like how we kind of arbitrarily cut it up into seasons, at least in our minds, but it doesn't actually manifest in any way on the website or anything.
No. It's kind of, we're like Netflix. It's just, you just can binge the whole season, the whole season.
We never take a break here, which is nice. We would tell you if we had to for some kind of reason, but I think there's some truth to, you know, if you do a podcast and you do it every single week, it will grow. It will do it.
I think that's one of the biggest secrets of podcasting is consistency. Mm-hmm. So, I've done other podcasts in the past that are great, but when you don't have a time slotted out, you don't really, you just don't do it, I think is the moral of the story. Mm-hmm.
So, I wonder how it works for some of the bigger podcasts, because, you know, like This American Life never misses a week, but what they do is just they replay an older episode if they're going to take off. But that means when you click on that icon in your podcatcher of choice, there's consistently something new to listen to there. Maybe you've already seen it or whatever, but, you know, they have so many episodes that the chances are you haven't. But then I powered through Invisibilia, great show, and now they're just like done. There's just like nothing in there.
What happened there?
They posted a like "See You Soon" episode that was like, "Hey, we're off season now. We did our first season, and that's that." And they don't have enough stuff to republish stuff, so I get where they're at. But it just seems like I don't know that they're doing a bad job. I'm sure that they're not. I'm sure that they're listened to by 12,000 times more people than Shop Talk Show is. But I prefer when I click on an icon for a show that there's consistently something new there, and that's what we strive to do.
Yeah. Yeah, and so vis-a-vis, ergo, this is why we're doing a rapid fire. So you have some content this week. Chris, tell them what rapid fires are all about.
Yeah, just no guests, no drama, just lots of questions. So there's not, you know, we're going to hopefully get through more questions than we do on a show with a guest. So that's the idea. Let's just jump right into it. Gabe Luce, who's one of our frequently sends in very good questions for us, writes in.
Should we like send Gabe a trophy?
You know, something? We do have that we really need to send out. And Sarah's always bugging me about this is that we have those hot drama mugs and we can't sell them because they're too expensive.
Let's do it. Let's send Gabe a hot drama mug today.
How am I going to remember to do this? Email myself?
I'll just put it in chat.
Send Gabe mug and our previous guests and stuff too. We gotta get rid of these mugs. They're awesome, but they're, you know, we can't sell them. We just need to get rid of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Gabe Luce writes in. My question is about empty sidebars on long pages. He puts pages in quotes and he says, "I'm trying to get away from using that word." I wonder what that is. Are we supposed to stop thinking about pages because the web's too dynamic for that or something? I don't know.
Yeah.
That's okay. I didn't know we were supposed to stop saying that word, but okay. Many websites have a sidebar column floated to one side or the other. Everybody knows what a sidebar is. Once you scroll past the content, you know, the chances are that there's more stuff in the content than there is in the sidebar, right? Once mm-hmm. you scroll past the amount of stuff in the sidebar, it's empty space. Like a blog index or another thing with lots of scrolling. I mean, imagine CSS Tricks. This is absolutely the case on CSS Tricks. There's way less stuff in the sidebar than there is in the average article. Once you scroll past the stuff in the sidebar, there's just nothing. Most websites I come across just deal with it. I guess they just, by deal with it, he means don't deal with it, probably. it's just empty space. He says, on a recent project, I was asked if I could do something about this, but I've had trouble coming up with good ideas that are simple, not hacky, etc. Thoughts?
My first thought is that this is where position sticky would be awesome, and that would be my initial solution. However, Chrome decided to rip position sticky out for a while until they fixed their compositing engine or whatever it is. So
I don't think I had my head wrapped around sticky all that well. When I think of a sticky sidebar, I think of the one when you scroll down to a certain point, you know, JavaScript detects the scroll position and then sets positioning on it. So it like, you know, stuff in the sidebar kind of follows you down, which is nice. That's like, you know, kind of, right? It just means that you don't have to do as much scrolling if something in that sidebar interests you in some way. Of course, that only is useful if... you kind of can guarantee that the sidebar is shorter than the viewport. So you have to be kind of careful about that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to scroll to stuff to the bottom of it because of the positioning is weird. Mm-hmm. So that's okay. You know, that's the follow kind of method. I've had did a blog post in the future that kind of just, or in the past that, you know, waited for the page to load, then measured the height of both of those areas. And then would AJAX for another module. In the case, it was just like, you know, related blog posts or something else that, you know, it doesn't matter. It's not, doesn't matter if it's not there, but, you know, if you have the space, fill it up. And then it would measure the heights again. And if it was still, if there was still room, it would go AJAX for another one. And yeah, that's kind of an idea, you know, it's a possible idea. It's a bunch of work, but, that's not the worst idea. It's like if you got the room, use it kind of thing. You could custom create something with JavaScript.
Like just lazy load in things if necessary.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, maybe that's jerky. Maybe that's like, you know, we just saw Tim Cadleck's new site. This is going to be weird because we're releasing this like a month later. But as we're recording this, Tim Cadleck just released a site called How Much Your Website Costs or something that was, you know, it shows that basically like a 2 megabyte or an almost 2 megabyte website, which is kind of the average size these days, amazingly enough, costs about US dollars a quarter for the average cheap mobile plan in Germany, which is kind of crazy. Yeah. You know, just going to a website for a quarter, you have a
it's like video games. Bill at the end of the Every year. Time you read a BuzzFeed, it's like, plunk, plunk.
So now think of this in relation to that. It's like every time you go to a website, it's like, you know what? I know this page is already loaded, but I think I'm going to fire off 10 more HTTP requests for a bunch of stuff. You know, you kind of, you know, it's even though it's not hurting the initial page performance, it is you are still choosing to suck up more bandwidth than they might be expecting. So there's ins and outs of everything.
I'm of the opinion, like, if it doesn't need to exist, don't put anything in there, you know, like keep it pure, keep it light. But there may be time, you know, but then again, if you have a long form article, like let's say a book, you wrote a book and it's, you know, 12 million words, you probably want to resurface some ads at some point. So maybe it does make sense to have like multiple sidebars or something like that. The Filament Group has a polyfill for position sticky, which is called fixed sticky, which will do a fixed element thing and then sticky if sticky is supported. So anyway.
I can sympathize with the publishing site, you know, being like, you know, it is our job, it is our business to keep people looking at interesting stuff on our site, and if there's room, we can do it. You know, like I can kind of see both sides of the issue. Anyway, good job, Gabe. Let us know what you do. We got
enjoy
another
that
one.
Mug. Enjoy that mug.
Enjoy the mug right. That we will probably remember to send you. What do we got, Dave?
Chris House writes in, it seems that in web dev land, Mac is the king and Windows is a footnote and Linux is the redheaded stepchild that nobody talks about. No offense to redheads here on the Shop Talk Show. Personally, I love redheads. Ability to have my dev environment identically match my production environment is the reason is reason enough to give Linux the edge over the two, not to mention how nicely it tools with Git, Sass, Grunt, etc. play like how they play with Linux. I know the inability to run Photoshop, Illustrator is a concern for some. My easy fix for this is to run a copy of Windows in VirtualBox, which also serves as a fantastic solution for IE testing. So, so it's interesting. Not really a question here, but like, what do you think about Linux as a development environment?
Well, that's a really good point, Chris, is that like so many servers are Linux that it is kind of true that you could match, you know, your development environment there. Although with things like, what do they call it? You know, the thing where you run little boxes on your own site. I use it.
VirtualBox?
Vagrant.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the answer to having a computer that you like and use for everything else, but matching your development environment perfectly. You don't have to have a Linux machine to do it. And you know that. He's using VirtualBox here to run Windows. So you could run and VirtualBox runs on anything, you know? You could use that same concept and keep your Mac or whatever. I'm not trying to defend Mac. I just, you know, I'm kind of an unapologetic Mac lover, you know. I've had my Mac forever. I have pictures of me as a kid like unwrapping old versions of, you know, that would be like the ultimate Christmas present to give me the latest Mac operating system. You know, it's not some, I've been a lifelong fan. It's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. It's true though that we're a little overly biased on this show because, you know, certainly in the world of computers, Mac is still as big as it's become, probably, you know, a smaller chunk of the amount of people using computers out there. I don't care what you use. I promise, you know, it's just so happens that what I write about is Macs because that's what I use. And that's just the way it is. We've talked about this before on this show though. I think Dave has some ideas here.
Oh yeah. I am personally kind of frustrated, you might say, with the like developer monoculture. Who smashed the monoculture? It is. Everything's Mac, Mac, Mac. Every time you Photoshop a website, it's on a Mac, an iPad, and an iPhone. And, you know, like it's, I don't know. I'm kind of over it, I guess. Like in a hipster, I want to drive a fixed gear bike kind of way. But
so you're exchange it for a different monoculture.
Yeah, well, so I think Linux is a really good thing. Like when people are like, if you're struggling on Windows to get a good dev environment up that is akin to all the blog posts and everything that people talk about, you know, maybe dual booting your Windows machine with a Linux environment like Ubuntu on the back end or something like that. You know, maybe that's a really good solution. Like you just say, hey, I'm going to, you know, partition part of my hard drive to have a Linux machine that I develop in. And then maybe you switch over to Windows to play games and do spreadsheets in or whatever. You know, Photoshop, Illustrator, those are definitely tools you need to have. Like you need some sort of high-end operating system, let's call it, not open sourceware. I know people are like, filling out the comment form right now. What about GIMP? It's like, GIMP's cool, but it's really not that great.
Of course, it depends on what you do. You know, you're in client work. Yeah. If somebody sends you a PSD at the high-end agency that is Paravel, you can't just be like, oh, sorry, I don't have Photoshop. That's just ridiculous. Yeah. You can't say that. That's the point here. If you don't do that kind of work, you know, maybe it would work for you. The point is we're open-minded here, right? Like, if you want to run Linux, awesome. You know, I think that's a perfect way to do it. You run a Windows machine, great. I would it be interesting to unveil your plan, or would you rather keep it a secret? I think it's kind of – I don't think it would hurt, possibly.
So I'm just interested in this idea, and I'll throw this out. Here we go. Throwing it out to friends at Microsoft or whatever. I got friends there, right? Like, I'm willing to switch to Windows for a year. I would do it. The Windows phone, Windows tablet, or whatever. Or maybe that's the same thing. Like, maybe it's a Surface Pro. Or maybe I have this super awesome
You're just all in on Microsoft.
Know, all in. Mr. Windows, Zune tattoo on my arm. Yes. Like, boom. I'm there. I learned recently, I've been getting into game development. You know what I'm talking about? And lots of game developers use Visual Studio. Actually, what inspired this was I was looking over the Shop Talk stats. Like, oh, I do this every year. I'm just like, let me just take an inventory of our stats, you know? And the Shop Talk audience is actually 50%, like 48 or 52% Windows. Yeah. Versus Mac on the desktop. And then iOS is actually like
that a sounds third about right, popular. You know. Like if on an average website, it's probably way more Microsoft, but it, you know, because web dev and stuff, it leans a little heavier towards Mac, and that makes sense. So 50-50 is interesting for us, but that's our audience. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of Windows of people that would appreciate you doing that. And the idea is that it's not you know, okay, it's a little bit marketing-y or whatever, but that's the point. You know, Dave, you have a presence. We do Shop Talk Show together. It would bring some balance to the show. It would be interesting for all of us because you would know what people are talking about more. You know, you could always have alternatives for the software. It's like, it makes sense for everybody.
That's what I'm interested in is like how, like, because we have a diverse audience here from multiple countries, you know, US and UK are the top two, but then there's a whole bunch after that. Like we're not, you and me, Chris, working on Macintoshes aren't really demonstrating the multi-device web because we probably have the same devices, right. Exactly, right? So
I'm terrible at it.
Well, I mean, who isn't? But it's like, I think it'd be really cool if we started embodying that here on the show. But then I learned through that game developer stuff, like, there's a free version of Visual Studio, right? And when I was like, when I first heard about Visual Studio, I was like, that is a dumb face, dumb face, right? Like, why would you ever compile code, right? But now that I use preprocessors, I compile code. Now that it has your version control, it has like whole project searching, it has like deep linking method support. Like,
it's kind of IDE like, right? It can even kind of sort of execute some code.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it has testing built in. Like, it's kind of a super editor, and now I'm curious about it. And so I don't know. I'm not saying like I'm switching over to that. I like Atom, but Atom is available for Windows. I'm just kind of like, I'm interested, and so.
But here's the catch. It would be a bunch of work for you to switch. It would cost you money. It would cost you time. It would cost you a little bit of lost productivity while you're getting it all jiggered up and stuff. So I just think I think it's a smart concept that it may, you know, what we're saying here is Microsoft, you should sponsor Dave to do this.
Let's do this.
Marketing for you. It's advertising for you. It brings balance to the show, and it would be fair and interesting. So, you know. And we can be upfront about it, you know. Money's gonna change hands, you know. But Dave's gonna do this, and we'll talk about it on the show because it just will come up naturally because Dave is using Windows now.
I am super amicable. Let's figure this out. All right, everyone, tweet. I don't know who.
Yes, we need a hashtag for Dave Goes Windows or something.
Dave Goes Windows. There we go. That's perfect. Hashtag.
All right. Goes Windows. Okay. Let's wait one more question to do a sponsor because that sounded okay. Like a pseudo sponsor. This one comes in from totally not Dave Rupert.
Interesting.
Okay. So totally not Dave Rupert writes in. So I have this friend who's building a Rails app, and she is wondering about authentication. Rails has this gem called Devise. That must be an authentication gem. And there's two standard plugins that aren't enabled by default, confirmable and lockable. Confirmable, as an option for device, will send an email confirmation to verify account. So by default, it doesn't do the email verification. You have to add this to do it. This seems pretty standard, right? Users may be pained by this step, but it's pretty standard even in a mobile-first world, right? Lockable, the other thing that's non-standard but is you can enable, will lock out the account after a few failed attempts. She thinks this feature is great for brute force security, but also wonders if it's just super annoying for users to have forgot their password. Should she enable both of these?
Wow. Well, totally not, Dave Rupert. That's a good question, and I'm interested why you were very concerned about hiding your gender.
I don't know what the gem is called that we use on CodePen, but we definitely do both of these things. The reason for confirmable, that's the one with an email confirmation we added later on. I think we might have even hand-rolled it. But it was because it was just to prevent spam a little bit. It was to prevent, if you don't, you know, and spammers certainly can make fake emails and confirm their email addresses. So it doesn't 100% block it, but it blocks more than it does if you don't do this. But we have penalties if you don't do it. That's the trick, is don't just do it for no reason. Do it like, okay, you can use some parts of this app, but not others until you're done with this. And you can use it then as like a logic gate for interesting parts. Like, oh, do you want to publish this story you did? Well, you know, you can write it and save it, but you can't publish it until you verify your email. You know, there has to be some things. So for example, on CodePen, you can't use full page view until you click it, and you get an interstitial page that's like, oh, I see you're trying to use full page view. That's fine. You can, but you have to verify your email first. You need to resend it. Click a thing to do that. No problem. So it's you know, you do it to block spam, but there also has to be something that it prevents you from doing.
Interesting. I'm sure totally not Dave Rupert's friend finds this interesting. The confirmable, that's interesting that you guys use it for like feature.
So you don't want to stop protection, them from right? doing anything. That's no good, you know?
Like, I guess, but that's also like your app is very user generated content where people want to spam, you know? You're not right. Like a private spreadsheet application or something, right?
Right, that's true. So because what, you know, you might get some spam registrations just because everywhere does, but or they're trying to hack you or who knows what. But yeah, it's not as desirable to spam a purely private app, you know.
And then the lockable, though, is you guys are locking people
it's the brute force thing. I think it's just kind of a best practice. You also will get people that nerds will email you. Just they decide that you should have that.
Nerds.
Yeah. So we have it just for that reason, and it's not a problem. It does not generate that much support. It does once in a while, and we're not to the point where we can answer all support requests within 10 minutes or whatever, which is the point at which it's already unlocked. So if we get an email about it, our response is usually like, well, it's been longer than 10 minutes, so you're already good, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that makes sense. That makes sense. I think it's just kind of, it rides a line on being super helpful in like giving people security, you know? Cause I would hate it if my CodePen account got brute forced or whatever. But some users might not understand that. And they're like, I tried all my passwords and now I can't even log in. I hate your software. Bye. You know? But again, you're probably dealing with more tech savvy users who remember their passwords. Possibly.
Yep. Possibly.
Okay. So right. General consensus for totally not Dave Rupert's friend.
Probably both.
Is probably do both, huh? All right. I'll, I mean, he'll or she'll let them know
Yeah, there's probably other reasons too. Maybe some people will write in. I think the confirmable email is like then you're kind of guaranteed that the email address that they used is right. So if you need to get a hold of them as a user, you can, because you know that it's right because they clicked the link, you know. Pretty good. Okay, so let's do a sponsor. We have lynda.com. We always sing it, right?
L-Y-N-D.
That was weird.
Angelic.
Was a little bit. / shop talk is the URL that you want to go to. You add the / shop talk so that we get credit, of course, so they continue to sponsor our show, but also because it's good for you. Going there gives you a 10-day free trial. Over 3,000 on-demand online courses to help strengthen your mind, your business, your technology, your creative skills, all kinds of courses on there. Here's some that are they recommend for the Shop Talk Show listeners. Illustrator CC for web design wireframing. We just talked about you should probably have these tools anyway for your business. Illustrator is a very powerful tool for that. It is perfect for wireframing, and you can do that. Android Studio Essential Training, up and running with Java. Bootstrap Layout. Responsive single page design, localization for developers. We get that question all the time here on Shop Talk. Up and running with Android Wear. They have programming courses up for Swift and iOS stuff. Yeah, pretty cool. So Lynda, that's lynda.com/shop talk. And if you're not already a member, you get 10 free days. So pretty cool. Let's do this Eric Highland one. Eric writes in, my question is, how did y'all strike a balance between your personal and business brands across all social platforms? How do you decide if a tweet should be from your personal account or your business account? When do you cross-promote? Does your message change across platforms, or do you simply repeat the same post on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, etc.? Or do you adjust your message based on the platform? Thanks. This is pretty interesting stuff. You know, it's easy to kind of poo-poo on, oh, are you a social networking guru? Are you applying for jobs as a social person? You know what I mean? Like, oh, you know, sometimes at conferences, or especially the open conferences, people are kind of like, ugh, here come the social media people, you know, at like bar camps and stuff. But there is some art and science to this stuff, I think. And it is kind of important because it's a way that businesses friggin' communicate these days. And sometimes you might be in charge of that. And sometimes, indeed, you might open your Twitter client and you do have, you know, your personal account and your work account, and you have to kind of choose what you're sharing. Is this me saying this? Is my business saying this? Should I say it in different ways? Can I use the word I in my business account as I tweet and stuff? Like, you know, Paravel has an account, right? Would you ever put a tweet with I in it? That seems weird because it's three people, right?
No. We take the hyper transparent sort of thing. You know, we'll never pretend we're a big company. We'll never pretend we're, you know, a one person ordeal. It's tough. I think the answer is like, go with your gut probably. What Shop Talk might be a good example. Like, what do we tweet from Shop Talk? And then
we're the worst. Use us as an example. As Dave put it once, we run a pretty weak social media game.
Yeah. We should probably get like a social media expert on the show. Or, you know, who's doing a talk is Sarah Parmenter is doing a really good talk about social.
Yeah. She's perfect too, because she started that business. So it's basically a salon, although they have a weird word for it in the UK, I think. I can't remember. I saw her talk on it once, and she, you know, she's this talented web designer that's like, you know what I'm going to do? I have this other dream. I'm going to start a friggin' hair salon business and kill it. And she has, and she's been, you know, making money and running that other business as well. I think she attributes a lot of her success to social media. So what couldn't be a more perfect person to tell us about that stuff?
So I think I heard her talk, and I think she's very much like in the Be Honest campaign, you know, like show your brand in an honest way. And I think, you know, like maybe your brand is only for messaging or self-aggrandizing or retweeting nice things people say about you or whatever. I don't know. But, you know, your personal should be you. But then again, your personal brand should never be so offensive that it totally scuds your major brand. I mean, if you still want to keep work, don't be a J-hole on Twitter.
Yeah, and don't put this stupid thing in your bio that says that these thoughts are your own. Of course they're your own.
Buh.
You wiener.
and I think the like cross posters that like let's call them blasters, they e-blast out to Twitter, Facebook, Google or whatever. I think those are atrocious. That's my personal opinion. I feel like that's just filling the internet with crap. You didn't think about it. You just filled it with crap. I think you have to kind of know that medium, you know, like there are people in Iraq who sell sheep on Instagram and stuff like that, like totally random, but they're like, they figured out how to use Instagram for their business. And that's probably what your business needs to do, is figure out how to use it for your business.
Right. Not just do it because everybody else is doing it kind of thing. There's got to be something you need to do, because I think the motivation is nothing. It's just like, if we had a bunch of followers, that's probably good for business or something. You know, there's not like any goal in mind necessarily. Which is probably true to some degree. I mean, you know, if you do have 100,000 followers, you probably are doing okay. You know, like if you have a new towel set you're trying to sell and you tweet it, you'll probably sell some towels, you know?
Exactly. You'll probably tweet it. Or what if your spouse like or partner makes a cool thing and they're selling it on Etsy, you'll probably tweet about it. But then
the trick is like, if that's all you ever did, maybe people are bummed out. So that's where the magic comes in. Like, well, should I tweet this Huffington Post article too? Because are people going to like that? And then it makes me seem like a real person. And then next time I have towels for sale, they'll remember how much they like following me and buy the towels more because I'm such an interesting social media presence. Oh my God. But it's kind of true, sadly. You know? You
do kind of have these background thoughts. So Chris, you do like CSS tricks and
right. And see, that's the kind of thing that I have no idea. Like, that's a good example because the interesting one, you know, I think, oh God, myself, I'm such a good tweeter. Look at me and all my followers. And then I have a friggin' robot account that all it does is suck down whenever new content is posted on CSS Tricks. It just auto-tweets it, which, you know, removes any personal voice at all. I don't @reply people very much on there. It's just this robot account, and it has way more followers than I do. People way rather prefer to follow this, like, brand robot content barfer than me, the human being. So what the heck do I know about social media? Nothing, apparently.
Well.
And then it just auto barfs to Facebook too, which goes in the face of what we just said about, you should know the platform and customize for it and, you know, do what people kind of more expect out of that platform. All it does is barf to Facebook too, you know. That doesn't do as well for us. So that's an example of failure.
Maybe you need to echo your polls on Facebook or something, you know, just something like that. Because Facebook has that feature.
And you can write a little longer on Facebook. You can, you know, you can engage and like people's comments back and stuff. There's certainly a lot you can do on Facebook that we don't, you know, there's not even a Facebook page at all for Shop Talk, you know. But that's because it's better. I think in some cases it's hard to ignore. You know, I think Treehouse at one point didn't have one and then did and then found that, like, wow, a ton of people engage with them on Facebook. It was stupid to ignore it kind of thing. I'm not sure if I have the details on that right, but I seem to remember that. So it's like, it's kind of like, duh, don't ignore Facebook. It's too big to ignore. But at the same time, like, just if we threw up a Shop Talk page, neither of us has time to deal with that. So it would actually, it might even hurt us to have this, like, lame, abandoned Facebook page or I don't know. It wouldn't feel right to me.
Right. It would feel unmaintained by default, sort of. Kind of a wasteland. I did a Facebook group for, or page for ATX Web Show, a now defunct podcast, but it was good. It was, it was hard to get engagement. You know, you kind of have to beg people to like the page so you can get a URL. Yeah. And then you have to like kind of, I don't know, you're just kind of constantly throwing things and hoping it'll take off. And I think that's really hard. I don't know. That's a lot of work, especially because we're already doing that work on weekly shows. You know, we're applying all of our efforts to make weekly shows work. So I wonder if there's an easy, I don't know, 80-20 rule kind of thing for social media. Oh, that would be interesting to know about.
There's a lot to know, Eric, and good luck on your journey there. We're going to do a sponsor for Environments for Humans. You know them, our longtime sponsors. We love them. We just got – the timing of this, again, is weird as we're recording this a little ahead of time. But me and Dave just got done speaking at the RWD Summit, so that's over. But so you can't do that one. But they have lots of other summits kind of coming up. And then they run in-person conferences as well. So this is until October. So this is one that we can definitely talk about, which is their CSS Dev Conf. The URL is cssdevconf.com. And I think by the time you listen to this, the call for speakers will sadly be over, but it's probably they're getting ready to vote on them. And it's well done how they handle this, because, you know, people submit their talk sessions. There's going to be a ton of them. And then people vote, but you vote blindly. You vote, look at, you know, you read their titles and you read their what their talk is going to be about, and then you vote on that. And I think you also vote just on names or something. They have some multi-step thing that you that you do, but they've picked out some, you know, some speakers that are going automatically, right? Just because that's just how they operate, right? So they have few faces to put on the front, which one of them is me. So I will be at it, and it's in Long Beach, California, and it's on this giant docked boat, you know, since like taking a cruise that doesn't go anywhere, but it's going to, like, what a cool place to have it, right? This conference is known for being in crazy locations, and they brought the noise yet again this year. It's going to be on the Queen Mary in Long Beach, California, coming up October 26th through 28th. I'll be out there. Hopefully you'll be out there too. We're just going to hang out and party on this boat. It's going to be absolutely awesome.
Nice. And I hope you got your call for speakers, and it ends April 5th. So there should be more speakers being announced relatively soon. They do a really cool double blind. So that's pretty cool. I think they kind of do. They take
You know, what's true is that what's cool about it is that in the end, after the double blind, you'll find that the gender split happens naturally, which is like, okay, proof in the pudding. There are biases that happen here, and you know.
Yeah, I wonder. I would love to see their like stats, gender stats.
I know they have some opinions about it. I've had dinner with Allison and Christopher where they talk about what they do to handle it and stuff.
They do a really good job. So, all right. Well, cool.
Okay.
Go spend a weekend on a boat. All right. Or a week. Dan J writes in, this is a question about salary. Here we go. What do you think about employers willing to pay $20 an hour or less with junior front-end developers? Does salary raise any red flags?
So it's always kind of fun when we throw out a number to actually talk about. It's kind of interesting. So Dan, looks like maybe you're a junior front-end developer and you were offered this as a salary to work somewhere. Certainly that's a lot more than minimum wage is, isn't it? I don't know what minimum wage is these days, but it's probably 10 or under, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about 1.25 or whatever, 2.25 or something. It's like $8 right now, which is very low.
I think it depends on state and even city a little bit sometimes, as I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because New York might go to 15 or whatever, New York City.
Yeah, I thought San Francisco is toying around with it too. But $20 is a lot more than that, right? But this is more skilled work, right? It's rarer. It's harder to find people. You have to pay more money for particular skilled jobs, of course. And That's not, you know, especially front-end developers. So, but you're junior, right? So it kind of makes sense that you're not making $100,000 a year or whatever. I don't hear a ton of people that get hourly pay in this industry, but I guess if anybody's going to abuse junior people, you know, I just think because like it tends to be kind of an adult job, you know, and mm-hmm. you're either kind of an intern or you're an adult and you're working full time, and that's just agencies and, you know, apps and stuff tend to just hire salaried people to do that. So I don't know. Does $20 seem really low to you?
You know, I just did the math. I did like 20 times 40 times 52, you know, just to see what a whole year of $20 an hour would be. And it's like $41,000. So it's almost like a teacher salary, you know?
Yeah.
When I think of it in those terms, I'm like, yeah, that's maybe okay. It depends on where you live. If you live in New York City, that's probably not enough money. But
The medium wage in the U.S. per person is $26,000. This tells
us. Well, so you're way ahead of the medium wage then. So.
Yeah, but, you know, it's the medium. That sucks, you know, 26. That's some poverty level stuff for sure. But the point is you are junior here and it goes up from there. So it seems like that's not a disaster for pay. I mean, certainly more is better, but. It doesn't seem like totally out of the question for a junior level developer.
That's what I would say. I don't think it's totally out of the question. I think if you're thinking about taking this job, I would maybe take it and then try to parlay that experience into more money. I mean, that's sort of how everything works, right? Is like you take a crappy job for a little wage and then you work your way up the corporate ladder or whatever. I mean, am I crazy to think it still works like that? Does it not work like that for millennials anymore?
Oh, it works like that.
Okay.
And if it doesn't, it's temporary and it's coming back.
Yeah. I mean, I think my first like dev job was less than that. So, I mean, that was some time ago. So, you know, I think it's all...
I listened to a podcast, a Planet Money, that said, who had the first job? Episode 593, that was pretty interesting. And they trace the origins of jobs. And it, like, they come up with some pretty interesting stuff. And the job, as we think of it today, is actually pretty darn modern. Like, really modern. Like, you know, not so many generations ago. You know, the kind of expectations of what a job is. So that was worth listening to. Link that up just for expand our minds a little bit. Dan Shields writes in, have you used or know of any existing tools that use JavaScript automation to check things on a pre-launch checklist? I have a Google Doc that I refer to every time I launch a site, but it seems like there's an opportunity to run some tests and automate the process a bit. Some example tests like, you know, checking if Google Analytics is in place, you know, making sure external font services are returning a valid response. That's interesting. Open graph tags are in place. No hrefs point to, you know, just the hash. Stuff like that. So Dan Shields has this checklist that he manually does when he launches a site. And I guess we could probably swap out the word launch with deploy, too. You know, a lot of us work on sites continually. And you'd want to check
continuous deployment.
Yeah. That's kind of interesting. When we had Mark on, right, and he was talking about at GitHub how they have some some deployment tests that test for, you know, even things as down to the metal as does this selector match any markup anywhere on the site? And if it doesn't, that's pretty deep testing.
Yeah. I think you totally could automate it. When was it? It was like 2008 or something. Like launch lists were super cool, right? Like everyone was launching a launch list. Am I right? And you know,
yeah, there was a little phase, wasn't there? Like make sure you have a favicon.
Yeah. And like, I'm looking at this one called lite.launchlist.net, which was probably the coolest one ever made, right? and it, you can email it to yourself. But it's like text free from spelling errors. You could maybe automate that. You content has been placed consistently. I don't know what that means. So probably can't do that. You know, print style sheet exists. You could test that. Metadata, like you said, you know, OG tags and all that, that you could test that. Page titles are descriptive and SEO friendly. You could probably, that's kind of human, right? Images have alt text. You could probably test that. Title attributes, don't use those actually in real life. Favicon, you could do that. Man, it seems like you could automate quite a bit of stuff. You know, broken links and stuff like that. You could actually use Google Web Page Tools. What, Google Webmaster Toolkit, is that what it is? And that actually does quite a bit of automation on your site. And that's kind of the continuous integration for front end. That's probably the most like norm core version of that, I would say, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't need to set up some grunt Jasmine jibber jabber on your own. But I don't know. Do you guys do any, I'm sure you do like feature testing and stuff on
code. Well, we just do normal testing. You know, we have a suite of Ruby tests and JavaScript tests, and they all run, and it doesn't stop our deploy. That would be a next level thing, which I'm totally interested in. You know, like if you have a failing test, it shouldn't let the code go out. Yeah. We can do that. You know, it's not like the technology is stopping us. It's just one of those things that we haven't gotten around to yet. We've had the fellows from CodeShip on this show before. We talked about continuous integration. I'm sure they have some, you know, tools, and they're all about this kind of thing. I think this is all very, very, very interesting. Like, this is next level stuff for, this is going to be hot for years to come. Can we kind of test everything on from a front end perspective and just make sure that the code we are pushing is working and matches anything we can think of that we demand for our site, you know? Maybe even performance testing stuff. Can that halt a deployment?
You know, there's Carl Groves. He's an accessibility guy. He released this app called Tenon.io. So it's a cool domain, on the coolest domain around, TENON.io. And it tests your accessibility. So you could actually roll this into some sort of Travis or whatever integration, and kind of block your deployment if you wanted to from there. So pretty neat stuff.
It really is. I can see big companies really kind of getting into this whole world in a bigger way. And they already are, you know, there's testing and stuff. But I like this idea of, like, I don't know, like heuristic testing, I guess. Like, look at all, and being able to write rules that are for, like, really open, that I can describe what I mean in an interesting way, kind of. Like, this is Google Analytics in place. How would you test that? Well, you have to kind of figure it out, you know, right? Look through these particular templates and look for this particular line of code, or and then to a deeper level, like, do you see a link at, you know, thing in HTML? Well, follow that URL. What status code do you get back? Is it is it 404? Oops, test failed. I've never heard of that.
There's even stuff like the headless testing things like Phantom, and then there's a Chromium one, and then there's even a new Trident one, right? Like a headless Trident. I think there's cool, like, I think we're approaching this era where you'll be able to kind of like test everything that's testable, which is kind of weird and cool and scary and sounds like a lot of work. But yeah, I don't know. I think like that cross browser thing, the ability to like get a console back from a browser that you're not looking at is cool. Like, to be warned about console errors. I know we have like some errors on Shop Talk site, like the our little subscribe button or something has a broken thing that I probably broke. So we could have caught that before we did that. So, yeah. I don't know. That's kind of cool.
Good luck, Dan. We got one from Peter here.
Yep. Peter Sorensen writes in, is there a point that WordPress suffers a performance hit due to a large database? I foresee our database hitting over a gig in the coming months, and I want to know if we should consider a different content management system. I've read that database size doesn't matter as long as you optimize and have a clean theme plugins. Can you please speak to this? Mm. Wow. So 1 gig database, you're probably there with...
Yeah, I think it's a couple of gigs on CSS Tricks because there's forums and lots of comments and posts and stuff. There's a lot of stuff up in my DB, and it does.
that's a t-shirt. It's amazing. We'll have to put that on Cotton Bureau. There's a lot of stuff in my DB.
In my DB. It does slow CSS Tricks down. I'm sure of it. It's been, you know, I can look at New Relic and see the database times are not great. And I don't really know. I've been fighting this for years. I have different people pop in to help. I have, you know, plugins I'm trying to, you know, get rid of. And performance is big for me on CSS Tricks. And I'm always kind of fighting slowness. And there's different types of slowness, right? There's the one that we talk about the most probably here on this show and that gets the most press is front-end related performance, is reduce requests and gzip stuff and all that stuff we talk about that it's wicked important. And then there's just that one other little thing as part of the waterfall chart is the first thing. How long does it take for that document to get there? And that number is all the back-end stuff combined. That's all the database calls and the caching and all that type of stuff too. And that, you know, it's not that that's ignored. That's talked about plenty. But, you know, if you, you know, move from one host to another host or something or make a bunch of back-end changes, that only affects that one little line in the waterfall chart of speed of website performance, right? And you want that to be super fast. You know, ideally it would be like 100 milliseconds or so. That would probably be like a good number. So you have like the rest of all, you know, the 900 milliseconds or so. If you're trying to get your page to render in a second, which would be a good goal, you have 900 left to do the front end stuff that you need to do. You don't want it to take, you know, 800 milliseconds for your document to come back. And that's where, you know, it's the PHP executing, it's the database calls being made. How many times does it have to hit the database? The cached or not or what. And I've found that in all the years of CSS Tricks in my several gigabyte database that it's slow. It's kind of slow, unfortunately. But what's actually happening there is like, is it, what's the deal? And nobody really has been able to figure it out. But it's not just, you know, WordPress, period. Because the classic example is that WordPress.com is a WordPress install. And it's one giant database for the millions and millions of users and posts and stuff on there. And it's not slow at all. So it's kind of like it's just something with my site or something with, you know, just there's something going on, you know. So I would say that, you know, if you went with WordPress and you probably will see some slowdown and stuff, whether that's a case for, it's not a disaster on my site. It's not, you know, it's not this huge problem that's untenable, especially because through caching, you can kind of hide it. It's actually, for my site, it's mostly the totally uncached, logged in. It's me as an admin on the back end going around. So when I say slow, it's slow. That's what I mean by slow. Like the front end normal performance that you'll experience browsing around CSS Tricks is pretty darn fast, actually.
Yeah.
But it's like when I, let's say I go and install, you know, get a brand new server and install a totally empty copy of WordPress. It's smoking fast. I go and I click new post and it's just like, boom, new post page is up. I go to CSS Tricks as a logged in uncached user and I go new post and it's like, and then it barfs out. You know, it takes a bunch of seconds to even to deliver up that page to me. And it's just... who knows what all, you know, databases related, all kinds of stuff is related. So you won't have any slowdown on a static site, you know, there's no database to slow it down. But should you switch entirely? I don't know. I think that's too hard of a question to answer. But I don't ignore it. You know,
don't ignore it. But I don't know if it's going to solve your problems. I mean, like if you have a 2 gigabyte or 1 gigabyte database, like chances are you have that. That's just content, right? And a little bit of metadata. Maybe you have a lot of metadata, and you need to kind of rethink that strategy. Like if you have 20 billion tags, well, if you had 6 tags, your queries would be a lot faster. So, because tags are kind of an expensive.
That's a very good point. It's not just the size of the database. It's definitely the structure and how it's optimized and how it's indexed and what queries are actually being called. And yeah, there's a lot to this.
In like Rails or, you know, maybe you could make some Go app or something that would be really fast. But everything's going to hit like a threshold of how fast it can get things from the database. There's a company here in Austin, you probably heard of WP Engine or whatever. That's the name of their company. But they're kind of focused on super performant WordPress. They can also do hosting, kind of like WordPress's VIP thing. It might be worth like poking around their blog and seeing what they're doing. They're very much, I've heard them speak because they're in town. They talk about how they limit plugins. They vet every plugin to make sure it's not just a total crap show when it hits production.
This is an interesting thing, actually. A lot of hosts publish a list of plugins that they don't recommend at all and won't support or even don't allow in some cases. And I had one of those running, unfortunately. I had a related post plugin. Those are rough, yeah.
Gonna kill you.
So what's interesting is Jetpack, which is that it's like a plugin that you can put on your self-install WordPress site that has features from WordPress.com, offers a related post thing, and they do it in an interesting way. You connect it to your WordPress.com account. You don't have to have your blog over there. It uses like the cloud power of WordPress.com. And it, because of their, you know, the kind of tunnel between the sites, then it can like read your blog kind of async style. It kind of knows what all your content is. And it says, okay, I see you want related posts for this post. Well, make an AJAX request and we'll do all the analysis, all that hardcore stuff that it needs to do up in the cloud. And then we'll send you back the results for that. So yeah, it's an extra request, but it doesn't burden your server. And then it returns.
And you're not making it like at runtime. It can be totally lazy necessary.
And it is lazy. You have really no choice about that because it's a, you know, it's an AJAX request, so it's by nature kind of async. It doesn't, you know, even that ended up not being my favorite, and I just killed it entirely. I don't have any proof that it was doing all that much for my traffic anyway. I didn't really care. It was just a little tiny design feature, you know. It's, you know, it felt kind of nice. You get to the bottom of an article and there's another article for you to read, but screw it, you know. It's certainly not worth having crappy performance, you know.
Another podcast, Code Pen Radio, you guys talk about scaling quite a bit because you have millions of pens and you need to kind of split that load. And so you guys kind of overcome that. But that's on an app like a Rails framework. So it's not a little different than like WordPress. So I haven't seen anything where WordPress is set up for sharding across 12 different databases.
No. But. No, we're not doing any sharding yet. We are kind of looking at Postgres conversion, and it's, you know, we have a kind of plan for that, although it's not 1,000% sure we're going to do it. I don't know. I guess it's not really worth talking about yet. It really won't affect anybody. It won't affect, you know, it's just we'll do it just for us kind of. And I think there's some, it's hard to say if scaling is, that's going to help it, because MySQL has room to grow too.
I think it would be worth checking your plugins, like pull your database down and like run a full like staging environment on your local machine and like look through your SQL query logs and find out what's slow.
Oh yeah. Running a slow query log is a very good thing to do.
And then just start. I mean, you have to do the hard work, man. You have to just start turning off plugins and seeing if it makes it better. You have to, you know, that it's tough. And I don't know. I don't know the best answer for you, but
one of the good answers is to just do a bunch of caching so that this problem is only for you. It's not for your users, you know?
Yeah, that's good too. Cause you can do lots of things with like WP total cache, right? Like you can prime.
Right. And then it's not hitting the database at all for a request. It's just it's hitting something in cache, whether it's a static file on disk or it's in op cache or whatever.
But if you have like user logins, which is kind of what you have on your forums, right? Like that needs to be a little more real time.
Yeah, so. I don't know. I have it off. I have caching off for the forums. I think there's just kind of some problems and I don't know. It's a little more rapid fast you have to decache, you know, as soon as anybody leaves a comment or anything.
Like you could maybe do a minute, but if somebody posts a comment and they don't see that comment, they'll be like so pissed. Like,
I know. It should just clear the cache for that page as soon as anybody submits any content, though. That seems like that would be fine, but I don't know why.
Right.
I don't know why that doesn't work or if I haven't done it in a while or whatever. I should probably just investigate it again.
Well. You'll get there.
I will. Let's see. That was the thing, and I'm sure we didn't totally answer Peter's question there, but you know, I guess the final answer is that I wouldn't necessarily abandon WordPress just because you think that this DB thing is a disaster. It will probably affect you on any system. The DB stuff is just complicated stuff. Eric Thayer writes in, I have the opportunity to build a new and improved. We're actually at an hour here. Maybe Eric, we'll start with yours next week. How about that?
Yep. We have a rapid fire next week. We'll start with that. Thanks everybody for listening. We really appreciate it. And yeah, be sure to rate us up in your podcatcher choice, favorite, like it, whatever. That's how people find out about the show. And we really appreciate it. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. And, get a new job. If you don't like your job, go to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a new job. And if you work at Microsoft, #DaveGoesWindows. Was that what we said?
Yep,
sure.
Yep, yep.
All right. Well, anything else?
Just that shoptalkshow.com.